It's like I don't know the I don't know 1 to 10. All right. Good afternoon and welcome. This is the hybrid commission workshop of October 12th, 2022, relating to the proposed resiliency code and LDR updates. And during this meeting, you can be here, you can be somewhere else, virtually. It's your option. We're happy to have you in either way. Why don't I ask our wonderful city clerk to give us the Zoom information so those of you who are watching will know how to raise your hand, because we haven't been doing this long enough.
Got it. So to participate or provide comment virtually during the commission workshop, the public may join the meeting by visiting the Zoom app on their smart device or on the web at zoom.us. The telephone numbers are 1-301-715-8592. I'm going to give you the toll-free number next. I'll say it twice, 888-475-4499. Toll-free is 888-475-4499. The webinar ID is 813-928-576-71#, 813-928-576-71#. Members of the public wanting to speak virtually on an item during the meeting must click the raise hand icon if using the Zoom app or press star 9 on the telephone to raise their hand. Thank you,
ma'am. Hey, just let me ask you, is the toll-free number, can they call only the toll-free number? If they call the other one, do they get charged?
They do not. But
so they're both toll-free.
Well, if you call from your cell phone, the 301 number usually is not charged. But if you're calling from your landline, it may be charged.
So why wouldn't you just always call the toll-free number?
We give you two options.
To be charged or not to be charged. Okay. That's government. All right. So listen, Mr. Mooney, our esteemed planning director, since this is your love child, I'm going to get in trouble for that. Why don't you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I'd be happy to. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thanks, Tom. So for the public, that we only have really one item. We're going to hear from Mr. Mooney and our new resiliency code that we need the public to also be told about. So you're going to give us about a 15-minute presentation so people understand. Are you going to explain that this is an RFP from about a year and a half ago, maybe?
Correct.
Okay, so are you going to give that background?
Yes.
Good. Okay, so I'm just going to wind you up and say start, and then we'll have questions. And is this a public hearing?
It is not.
Okay. Seraldo, did you want to say something about it? All right. No problem. It's a workshop, and you seem to care a lot about these issues and have something to say, so we'll hear from you. But go ahead, Tom.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the commission. Thank you for attending this workshop today. I believe that Commissioner Miner may be participating via Zoom as well. As the commission is aware, we brought the proposed resiliency code and LDR updates to the body for first reading on September 14th, and it was approved. Second reading has been set for October 26th. It will be an after 5 p.m. public hearing. And the commission also requested that we schedule a separate public workshop for the purpose of going into a few more details regarding the code. And Rahelia Madon, who's really been the mastermind behind this, will take you through a very brief PowerPoint presentation. It's going to be a little bit different than what you may have seen in the past, both at first reading and at a number of the workshops that we've had at the Planning Board and at the Land Use Committee. But we think it will address some of the questions that had been raised and some of the concerns that we've heard expressed. After Rahelio provides his presentation, we're hopeful that our consultant from the GridX team will be able to join us via Zoom to give you about a five-minute overview on some of the graphical interface benefits of this proposal. If he's having technical problems, we have some additional slides that we'll show you. When we're done making our presentation, we certainly will be here to answer any questions that you may have, that the public may have, both online as well as in person. So with that, Rahelio, you can take it away.
Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. Can we bring up the PowerPoint presentation? Okay, so this is the PowerPoint presentation for our workshop today. We've been working with our consultants at Perkins & Will, Pluserbia Design, Helibert Sanchez & Associates, Nancy Stroud PA, Coastal Systems International. We have with us a consultant from Pluserbia, Maria Benfeldt, who's with us in case there's any other questions regarding the sections of the code that she has worked on, which is Chapter 7. Next slide, please. So this is just a quick overview of all of the public meetings that we've had. We've had focus groups with several organizations throughout this last year. We've had several meetings at the Land Use and Sustainability Committee. We've had community meetings at the planning board level. We've had two community meetings. We had a transmittal meeting for the planning board where they transmitted the code to the city commission with a favorable recommendation. And then first reading, as Tom stated, was on September 14th. Next slide, please. So I'm going to go primarily into the resiliency components of the code to begin with. So next slide, please. So first of all, we've consolidated a lot of the resiliency components that exist in our existing land development regulations that are located throughout several sections into one area. We've created into the beginning of Chapter 7 of the code several resiliency components. A lot of them are currently there, and they include sustainability and mitigation standards that we hope will make new buildings and new construction more resilient. Some of the changes that we've made is we've changed vertical elevations to be tied to base flood elevation so that the code can remain up to date. Currently, several of our standards are tied to grade or the sidewalk elevation. So as science changes, as sea level rise projections change, as FEMA flood predictions change, our code will change with it because these elevations are tied to base flood elevation. We've incorporated existing green building standards into this section of the code, which currently they're incorporated into a separate section of the code. So by incorporating into Chapter 7, architects will be able to find the standards easily that they will have to comply with. And we've created a new section for original green standards that we can elaborate on in the future to create specific things that we want buildings to incorporate in order to become more sustainable. And then we've created a new section that provides frontage design guidelines, which I'll show a sample of that in a few seconds. Next slide, please. So our code today has standards for ground floor of non-residential buildings. We divide those into long and short frontages. And so one of the things that we've done with this code proposal is to add an increased number of graphics so that architects can really understand what we're trying to say today with text. So with our long frontage standards, architects will be able to look at these graphics and see exactly what they're supposed to do to make sure that their ground floors are more resilient. So you can see here the sidewalk level, how it's divided into a landscape area, a clear pedestrian area, and a transition zone. They can see how a commercial storefront is supposed to have a knee wall, and they can better design their frontages in accordance with our standards. Currently today, it's all written down and it's in text, and so we have to spend a lot of time hand-holding the hands of architects to describe what we're trying to accomplish with these. Another standard, this is one change that we've proposed, increase the minimum height of non-residential ground floors from 12 feet to 14 feet above the design flood elevation. This is because we've looked at sea level rise projections. The South Florida Climate Compact has updated their projections, and we feel that in order to ensure that buildings are able to adapt well into the future, they need to have those two extra feet in their ground floor. However, this does not affect the overall height of buildings. The overall height of buildings has not been changed as a result of this.
Can I ask you a question? There are a couple of places that where you see a building, a residential building, that just seems towering mm-hmm. over the usually the one-story building next to it, although sometimes two. Is that because of this, or are there other allowances that are happening?
So if you're talking about single-family districts,
yeah.
That's because we have allowed height to become measured from the base flood elevation. Previously, height used to be measured from grade, which was the sidewalk elevation. So while our height limits have not changed over several years, where we measure that height from has changed. And so that does allow for new homes to be built at a higher elevation. However, that's with the intent of ensuring that these buildings are resilient over the long term.
And the reason for that is because base flood elevation over the last few decades has been changing significantly. Right. So a lot of older homes that may have been built in the 30s, 40s, even 50s, they didn't have the same base flood elevation requirements that we have now. So even if we were not measuring height from base flood elevation, they were still going to have to locate their first habitable floor at a minimum of base flood elevation plus 1 foot, which is in and of itself going to create sort of an out-of-kilter relationship with neighboring properties that were built much lower.
Commissioner.
Yeah, I was watching an interview recently talking about the tragedy that occurred with Hurricane Ian, and they were talking about some statistics about homeowners in the Fort Myers area, et cetera, and I was shocked to learn that the percent of homeowners that have flood insurance is so low. Per the report, it was in the single digits in terms of percent, 4, 5, 6%, which is shocking to me. And they're going to find real hardships because a lot of homeowner policies do not include flood insurance. So, when we start talking about things like building above a base flood elevation, and then you start getting pushback from folks, I think we need to bring in some expertise from the insurance market so that folks start to understand that if you don't do this, you won't get flood insurance. We have hurricanes down here, sadly. And when a tragedy happens like happened in Ian, you're going to have homeowners that literally are bankrupt because they don't have the money to fix up their homes. And for most people, their home is their nest egg. So, when we start toying with this, we start putting people in positions where they won't be able to get flood insurance. And if they can't get flood insurance, and heaven forbid we ever have a major, hurricane or weather event, they can lose their homes and their financial nest egg.
Hey, is there a, I know with the storm windows, for some time they've been giving discounts. And probably most, if not all, but probably most of single families are in Citizens or one of the takeout companies. What is the, do they give a discount? Do you know whether the planes are such that, is floodplain elevation of the home something that is taken into effect in factoring your actual insurance? Do you guys know that?
I know from personal experience, I live in the Gables, and it's one of the highest elevations in Dade County, and I was not even required to get flood insurance. But if you are in one of the zones in a coastal high hazard area like Miami Beach, my understanding is that if you're moving into a home where you are below BFE, the mortgage company will require you to get flood insurance. Otherwise, you cannot get a mortgage. And that the federal government has been subsidizing that over the last couple of decades. That may be in flux, but I know a lot of people have expressed to us when they've come in for permit that they want to have the flexibility of not having to spend money on flood insurance, and that's why they're building higher. And even the ones that can afford flood insurance have said, I don't want to deal with my home being flooded.
Yeah, correct, yeah. And I think next time we go through this presentation, maybe bring some experts from the insurance industry just to talk about premiums and the, sometimes inability to underwrite flood insurance because people are below the floodplain and, the hardship that causes homeowners. I think that would be a useful part of this discussion.
Mr. Eskin, thoughts?
My first question is, what is the state of Florida mandating versus what we're mandating right now?
So they mandate construction at base flood elevation plus one, and we're at the same requirement. We do allow them to go a little higher than that, but our minimum standard is base flood elevation plus one.
Okay. I mean, I would advocate for following what the state of Florida is doing right now.
I would advocate for following the state of Florida right now so that you don't get that massive disconnect in neighborhoods. I don't know if you've been over to Belle Isle recently where they built this massive home that just rose out of this neighborhood, and it's really ruined the entire neighborhood. There has to be a way to do this incrementally instead of mandating something, in my opinion, that's going to ruin everybody's experience in the neighborhood. And my second question is, could we exempt historic districts from this? Because what you don't want is to begin to have this super disconnect right in the middle of our historic districts based on, let's say that you buy a historic building and you want to do 30 or 40% renovation. I don't know when it kicks in where you have to put pull everything up to code, but that could be a serious problem, you know, on Ocean Drive or someplace like that. So I don't know how you feel. I would like to, how many votes do we need to pass this resiliency code?
Five.
So we'll be voting on this two times in October and November?
October is second reading.
October is the second reading of the resiliency code.
Most of these standards are already in the code today regarding the floor elevation. That's already in the code today.
The BFE, base flood elevation, plus one.
Yes.
So plus then what's the difference between what we're doing right now and...
So the slide that I had on now was related specifically to commercial buildings. What we are proposing to change in my next slide on single-family homes is the yard elevations is proposed to change a little bit, but the actual building elevations... we are proposing a change for understory homes.
Okay.
So,
and to your question on historic districts, Commissioner, right now we only have three areas of the city that are historic districts that contain single-family homes. There is a four-block area at the northwest corner of Flamingo Park, there's Palm View, and there's Altos del Mar. Any new homes within those areas, regardless of the new state legislation regarding the demolition of single-family homes, have to be reviewed and approved by the Historic Preservation Board. So as in using Altos del Mar as an example, there is a 12-foot wave crest requirement for new homes in the Altos del Mar area because it's on the ocean. And any new construction has to meet that according to state law. But the Historic Preservation Board still has to review that. And the same holds true for the Palm View area and Flamingo Park. If new single-family construction is proposed, although it does have to be at a higher BFE, the Historic Preservation Board would review that new construction for compatibility with the surrounding district.
So let's say that I'm adding a bedroom or a room onto my home, right? And at the same time, I decide to do my kitchen and the bathrooms. I'm just doing a general renovation and adding an addition. Are you going to require that addition onto my home to be at this new higher elevation?
Well, the higher elevation is mandated by the Florida Building Code. And my understanding of the Florida Building Code is that you can do up to a certain percentage of an addition at the same elevation that you are now, but that once you cross a certain threshold, that addition would have to be at BFE plus one. And the way people have accommodated that in the past is that they've created a transition from their existing home into the new addition through steps or ramps or other mechanisms.
Do you know what the percentage is when that kicks in?
No, I could find out from the building official and get back to you on that, though.
Okay, I believe it's 50%.
Oh, it's a 50%. So I can add on up to 50% of my home without having to raise it to the new. Okay, I think that's free. We're not changing or going above or beyond that. Okay. Mm-mm. Those are my only questions.
Keep going.
No, that's all I have for right now.
Keep going. And can you make the font a little smaller?
Yes. I can hand out magnifying glasses. This is just a quick slide. I don't need to go into huge detail on this. But this is showing you a new section of the code for a resiliency component. This is frontage design guidelines. So this is basically giving architects an idea of how frontages should be designed for commercial buildings, for residential buildings, different types of buildings, so that those frontages are resilient. They transition down into the public right-of-way appropriately, and they function well for the city. So this is giving architects an idea. Currently, our code doesn't have graphics like this, so everything is done talking with architects, negotiating with them. So this will basically give them a guideline that they can look at before they even come to the city so they know that they're moving in the right direction. Next slide, please. So I think we missed one slide. There we go. So this is one proposed change. So this is the yard elevations. I know it's a little bit tough to see. We are proposing that yard elevations for single-family home be a little bit higher than what they are today, and that those elevations be tied to base flood elevation. Currently, they are tied to grade, so that's the sidewalk elevation. So depending on how high the sidewalk is in front of your house, the standards for the yards can change. We're trying to make it where everything is uniform. That makes it easier for our staff to review, easier for the architects to interpret, and also makes the homes ultimately more resilient. So we are proposing that the minimum yard elevations, currently the yard elevation is 6.5 NGVD. We're proposing that that be raised to 7.13 NGVD. So that would be about 7 inches higher than what is required today if you were going to build a new home. The yard elevation, the front yard elevation, we're allowing residents to be able to go 10 inches higher than what's allowed today. Side interior elevations to be 2.6 inches higher than what they are today. So we are proposing some very slight increases in terms of the maximum yard elevation. They don't have to go that high, but they could go that high if they so choose, if they feel that they're going to get significant benefits for their flood insurance, keeping their properties dry in case of sea level rise, king tides, storm surges, whatever the case may be. So that is a proposed change for the single family section. And then you can see on the right, I know it's difficult to read, but you can see how the code will be presented to architects and residents. It's going to include graphics so they can see precisely what numbers are referring to, what a yard elevation is, what a yard setback, yard elevation, where that is specifically referring to in a graphic form as opposed to the text format that we currently use today. Next slide. This is another change that we're proposing for single-family homes in order to allow for the construction of understory homes. Today, understory homes are allowed with the approval of the DRB. We're proposing that they be allowed with administrative approval if no variances or waivers are requested. Additionally, we're proposing that we allow an additional 3 feet in height for understory homes. So that would take a home to 31 feet for flat roof, 34 feet for a sloped roof. Currently, we're allowed 28 and 31 respectively. The height is intended to make understory homes more usable, facilitate comfortable living spaces above ground, and then increase the resilience of single-family homes. So currently today, oftentimes when an understory home comes to the board, they're requesting waivers to reduce yard elevations, and they're requesting variances for height, 3 feet height, and we don't want to encourage applicants to have to require variances and waivers. So we are proposing to facilitate this. We feel that these types of homes are more resilient to sea level rise and storm surges and can improve the resiliency of the city. Next slide, please. Now I'm going to go into the structure of the code. Next slide.
I just have a question.
Yes.
Mr. Mayor.
Oh.
Through the mayor. Following Robert's rules, but the mayor sounds.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, through the mayor. let me just ask a question for my own edification here. What is, when we're talking about existing homes,
mm-hmm.
let's say homes built in the 50s, the 60s, or even earlier than that, what would we say is kind of like the average grade right now?
It depends on where in the city. The further west you go, the lower that number is. So the grade elevation, which is the sidewalk elevation, can be any 2 NGVD, 3 NGVD, and then maybe the home would start at 4. Yesterday we were looking at some single-family homes, and they were about 4, 4.5 feet.
And what's NGVD. The BFE?
Base flood elevation would be 8 NGVD, and then the minimum height of a new home would be at 9 NGVD.
Okay. So from a neighboring property that's at grade to a new property that will be built at BFE mm-hmm. plus 1, that could be a substantial increase.
Yes.
As part of the changes that you're doing here, I mean, are we doing anything to require somehow, you know, I think residents oftentimes fear,
mm-hmm.
You know, their home may be lower and then you have a new home that's going to be built much higher,
mm-hmm.
the impacts it could have on their property. Are we doing anything to, and in fact, and we've seen it even mm-hmm. with our own construction of capital projects and improvements when we've done our infrastructure improvements. Are we doing anything to require for these new homes to have collection of water to protect the neighboring properties?
So when you raise your yard, you would be required to have retaining walls in order to ensure that the storm water is maintained on your site and that you don't affect your neighbors. And then it happened a few years ago as part of when we were first incorporating these types of regulations into our land development regulations. We increased side setbacks a little bit to ensure that that there would be a little bit of relief to the next door neighbor from having the larger structure in order to improve the transition. So those are the big things that have been done in order to minimize.
But besides a retaining wall and, you know, increased setbacks, no real infrastructure to handle
Commissioner, you know, the absorption of water. The Public Works Department in their Public Works Manual has minimum water retention requirements that all new homes have to comply with. And those evolve. And so any new home, in addition to the increase in yard elevation and requirements for a retaining wall, which ironically were not part of the LDRs, we would enforce them as part of the building department standards. But now we've put them in the LDRs so that architects, when they're designing it, know they need to start designing homes with adequate retaining walls and with adequate on-site water retention. Those will go a long way, we believe, in preventing the runoff of water to a lower property. But the Public Works Department in their Public Works Manual does have minimum on-site water retention standards that they must adhere to in order to get a building permit.
And how about how does it work for, let's say, with a public right-of-way? Because I can think of one specific property where the road, I mean, where the home is higher, built higher, the sidewalk was built higher, but then the sidewalks in the neighboring properties flood. And so that's outside of that retaining wall infrastructure. How does that get mitigated?
That's something where I think what you're talking about, because I've seen these homes too, where they slightly slope up the sidewalk in front of the home with a raised yard. Because the sidewalk slopes down, that has the effect of causing flooding on the neighboring properties. I believe that in order to slope your right-of-way up, you have to substantiate that the water runoff will not just occur to the side, but will also occur within the right-of-way. And I know that that's something that the Public Works Department has been working on as well. I can ask them about that before a second reading to get you some more definitive information on that. Because that's in the public right-of-way, that's not technically part of the LDRs. We rely on the Public Works Department to review that as part of the building permit application where they're modifying the right-of-way.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. If we can go back to the presentation.
Yeah. Let's see how low the font can go.
Okay. So this is the layout of the code. Yep. Currently, our code starts in Chapter 114 and goes all the way to Chapter 142. With eight chapters today. We're now going to have seven chapters, so you're going to see it'll be organized Chapter 1 through 7. Next slide, please. So for our first chapter, general provisions, we're consolidating all of the definitions into this one chapter. Currently, our code has definitions all over the place. So it's very difficult to follow. If you want to see where something is defined, we're moving everything to the beginning now. We're organizing definitions by type. So if you want to look at definitions related to single-family homes, you'll see them organized in that way. Definitions related to commercial buildings, you'll see them organized that way. And then you'll also see definitions organized in alphabetical order. We're aligning use we're adding a few new definitions. We're adding a definition for gross floor area, a definition for terrace, porch, neighborhood impact lot, which is lots over 20,000 square feet, which is a term we use in our code today, but we really don't have a term that we use as a name to catch all neighborhood impact structures. We're consolidating use definitions, such as administrative office, professional office, and business office, which are defined separately today. We really treat them the same way, so we're consolidating that, and we're updating graphics. You can see the way the graphics were in our current code, and now we're going to have some nicer graphics that are a little easier to read. Did you have a question? Okay. Welcome, Commissioner. Next slide, please. For Chapter 2, which is our administrative and review procedures. This is our clerical procedures. This is if you file an application. These are the processes that you follow. We are proposing a few changes. The first is to create a new annual four-time-per-year zoning cycle with the ability for the City Commission to waive that cycle with a supermajority vote. This is currently, we have several amendments every month, and this is very difficult for the public to keep up with us to keep up with as staff processing these amendments, and for architects to stay up to date as to what's happening with the code when they submit when they submit plans to the city. So this is intended to facilitate that. We are proposing to create a new process for commission warrants. This would allow the City Commission to modify code requirements by up to 25% for specific projects in order to minimize the need for future code amendments and provide better control for development proposals. So the idea here, the process would be the same as an ordinance amendment, but instead of an amendment to the code, you would actually see the project and be able to waive standards by 25%, and you would get guarantees that the project that is before you is what will actually be built. Currently today, let's say there's a proposal that's requesting a height increase in the code from 100 feet to 125 feet. You really have no guarantee that the project that is being shown to the City Commission is what will get built. With this proposal, it's the same process that you would have to go through to get an ordinance amendment. It would have to go to the Planning Board and two readings at the City Commission, but it would be tied to a specific project in the form of a special permit and not as just a general amendment to the code that anybody could utilize. So we feel it would give the City Commission a little more assurances as to what they're getting. And the City Commission could also impose conditions on the special permit in order to safeguard the impacts and improve the conditions for the city. Yes.
So this would only happen 4 times a year? So the quarterly?
The code amendment process would only be 4 times a year. That's what you have today, that we get ordinance amendments every month. That the idea was that would only happen 4 times a year. If there's a specific project that needs a warrant, that would not be subject to the time limitation. However, it would get public notice similar to the process that is utilized today.
So you guys would come before us quarterly with a list of projects, and we're going to go through and one by one waive the code requirements for those projects specifically?
The warrant wouldn't have that 4-time-a-year limitation, so that could happen at any time of the year. But it would be, let's say an applicant needed a warrant to modify setback requirements, or they needed 10 extra feet of height. You would get a warrant before you. It would have an order that would have the conditions, what regulation, the code section that they would like to change. And the percentage that they would be changing it. And then we would have tie that to a specific project. So you would see a set of plans, and that warrant would be tied to that set of plans. And if they wanted to change their plans for whatever reason, they would have to come back to you and modify their warrant. And then ultimately that warrant would have to be approved by either the Design Review Board and the Historic Preservation Board the same way as it is approved today.
And that's different. Okay, wait. And that's not create a new annual 4-time-per-year zoning cycle. That is bullet number one that you were just saying, or it's not? Because I lost you.
Bullet number one is for a code amendment. So if we're actually changing the text of the code,
mm-hmm.
let's say we have a new code amendment to increase the height in a district.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a more of a policy direction. We're changing the height in this area. That type of an amendment could only come 4 times a year.
But what sometimes when people are already complaining that the entire process takes too long. So mm-hmm. let's say that you come in at the beginning of the cycle, so we're going to tack another 3 months of paying expenses on a mortgage and insurance and all of these things for the code amendment. That to me seems like we're passing that burden onto business owners who are already complaining about our process.
Well, that's not the land use board process. Right now, if a property owner wants to develop their property in accordance with the current regulations, that process isn't changing. So they'll be able to go through the land use board process, whether it's historic preservation or design review board or planning board if required. They can still go through that as they do now. What we're talking about in terms of the LDR amendments is whether it's something that has been recommended by the city manager, whether it's an amendment that is proposed by a private applicant because they're seeking a different use than what is allowed now, or they want more height, or they want another change. That is the type of code amendment where we're suggesting that a 4-times-per-year cycle be established so that we can get more control over the number of amendments that are looked at. The commission can waive that for those code amendments that it deems to be either an emergency basis or of sufficient public caliber that it should proceed outside the 4 times per year cycle.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is just so that it's more organized?
Correct. It'll help organize it, and I think it'll be good for both the commission and for staff in terms of organizing these code amendments. We're hopeful that with the new code adopted, you'll see less of these, and potentially with a warrant process, you'll see even less, because a lot of the code amendments that you guys get, while they are not specific as written to one project, from a practical standpoint, they're for a single project.
But we're not going to be voting on the warrants this upcoming October, are we?
No, you would be voting on the process. You would be voting on the code amendment to establish the process. If it's made part of the code, then anybody who seeks a warrant in the future, then they would be coming before you at a later date to request the warrant.
And we, a supermajority of the commission, and so the warrant would be 6/7 vote?
5/7.
5/7.
Just like a code amendment.
And give an example of somebody who's going to be coming before us with a warrant, and why would they would need to come with us, come before us with a warrant.
So probably a good recent example would be recently you adopted a code amendment to increase the maximum allowable height and number of rooftop additions, number of stories for rooftop additions in the museum historic districts for CD3 properties to accommodate the Gale Hotel, which is on the south side of 17th Street. Under the warrant process, they could potentially come to you with a warrant application and say, rather than amending the code so I can have 10 additional feet of height, here's my project. I need this additional height. The advantage to you doing that under the warrant process is that you would be reviewing the actual project, all the massing studies, the design of it, and you'd be granting the additional height based upon that project. Whereas once you amend the code, it could be 5-10 years down the road before that owner or a different owner or another owner 2 times removed decides to do the addition, and they may do a design that is completely different than what you may have seen. You can also impose conditions as part of a warrant, and you can set forth a time frame for which the construction must move forward and be completed as part of a warrant. So it gives you actually a lot more control.
Right.
And you can no longer amend the code without, for example, let's say that you came before us and you have a government use lot and we're completely amending the code to, I don't know, kind of Chinese, RD, whatever you just said. So before, for example, we would put something on the ballot, we would have to actually see the project and approve that project before we amended the code, correct?
The only time that you're required to put something on the ballot is if it involves an increase in FAR. So if we were proposing an amendment to the GU regulation, say to reduce parking, mm-hmm. we've proposed GU amendments in the past to reduce parking or to increase height, then because it's GU properties, the city potentially could make an application for a warrant, or we could request that the commission amend the CCC regulations or the GU regulations for whatever property that affects.
And the warrant is 5/7 vote, and the amending of the code is 5/7 vote, so correct. It's the same thing. So the warrant is kind of like a legal spot zoning?
It's a special permit, so it's not rezoning. It's not changing the code. It's a special permit for a specific project.
I mean, I guess I can see the benefit of that, because let's say that you're going to pass zoning in a certain area and you're giving additional height. Maybe you don't want every building in that area to have that additional height, only that one property, and then anybody else there who wants. So you're saying it's actually people can't just get the zoning and then flip the property is what you're saying.
And I just want to understand, if you yield, colleague.
Yeah.
Because I just want to also understand. This is, I guess, an additional option that people have. Mm-hmm. People could opt to do the code amendment process now, like what we have now, but that will be through cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, they could request a waiver. Now, what I see right now, we have a flawed process where we're making code amendments for specific projects, and then those projects don't happen, and then the property, as you mentioned, Commissioner, the property is flipped, and something else is developed there. With the waiver, with the warrant process, is very project specific. And let me ask you this: can an applicant proffer that they're going to give up rights that right now, you know, they may be entitled to? Can they proffer limits on noise or certain types of uses or certain types of activations through the waiver process? What is it called?
The warrant.
Warrant process.
Nick, I believe that since they are requesting a special exception, that they could proffer something in addition to what the minimum code requirements are, correct?
That's right.
So as part of an approval, we could get concessions from an actual property owner tied to this versus in a code amendment process, it's more difficult because it's not tied to a project. So we're amending the code, we're giving someone more rights, but we may not get concessions that we may otherwise now be able to get through the warrant process.
I think an applicant could make voluntary proffers as part of a warrant application that could become binding if the commission included them in the order.
Okay, that's interesting. Are there any other questions?
Yeah. I understand where it's coming from, but I think the reason that you have these codes and sections to begin with is so that you don't have like one crazy building in a section of like townhouses, or you know, you want something that's somewhat uniform. And I feel like this process is just going to give us a jumble of stuff, you know, that's not conforming, and it's going to encourage non-conforming uses. Don't you agree?
No, I think that what it will do is enable the commission, ironically, to actually have more control over a lot of these requests. The thing to keep in mind in Miami Beach is that we're basically a built-out city. And in most areas of the city, you have existing buildings that are much lower in height or much lower and smaller in size than what you could otherwise already build. People oftentimes request relief from things like setback and height and parking because of characteristics that are very unique to their project. And they are forced to do that now through the code amendment process. Ultimately, this body retains full control over that. There's been a number of amendments that have never gone forward simply because they were either asking for too much or it's something that couldn't be supported. But the warrant process would essentially do
but
the
let
same
me ask
thing,
something.
But give you more control.
Let me ask something. With a warrant, let me do this instead. With a code amendment, is there a limit as to what a code amendment could be in a zoning district? Is there a limit on how much height increase? No. Is there a limit on how many parking waivers or setbacks? No. With a warrant, is there a limit on the amount of changes that you could do to the actual written code?
There's a cap of 25% the way it's drafted right now.
So in other words, if the current code says that you can build up to 100 feet, this would cap it at 100 feet plus 25%, mm-hmm. whereas the current code amendment process is open-ended.
Correct.
But yet we're still doing the warrant process right now in our current practices. We're just not tying it to a project.
Mm-hmm. It's a code amendment.
So yeah. This, in fact, actually puts on us and on the community, I think, more restraint, because someone that wants to use this process actually has a limit on what they can use this warrant for. It's up to 25% change, whereas the current code amendment process, which has been done at this table countless times, it's unlimited what the change could be.
Okay. So when you change a code amendment, you have to follow certain notice guidelines. Would the same notice guidelines be in place using the warrant process?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, in some ways, Commissioner, they would exceed it, because depending upon the type of code amendment that is being proposed, if it's just a text amendment, the notice requirements are less, whereas with a warrant, they will be uniform, regardless of what the request for the warrant will be.
And this would be abolishing the non-conforming use then, because you would no longer be amending the code, really. You would just be giving these warrants.
This does not affect uses, so you cannot use the warrant process for uses. If you do want to allow a use that's currently not allowed today, you would have to amend the code and potentially amend the comprehensive plan.
Let's do something, because I think you were in the middle of your presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Colleagues, if it's okay with you all, I don't know if Commissioner Minor, Commissioner Real, if you have any questions at this juncture, or you want to, okay, would you proceed?
Okay. Okay, so we created the warrant process. The other change to this chapter, which is the administrative and review procedures, created a new conditional use criteria for pedestrian safety and comfort. This is in order to enhance the ability of the planning board to impose conditions to improve the pedestrian environment. And then we've also modified the requirements for waiving applicable fees for code amendments. We're basically allowing the City Commission to issue waiver of fees. Currently today, it requires that the fees either be for a nonprofit organization or it has to be recommended by the city manager. The amendment has to be recommended by the city manager. This just makes it easier for the commission if they want to waive the fees as part of a code amendment. The commission has the ability to do that. There are no changes in this code section for historic preservation. All of that stays the same. Yes.
So there are HPB and DRB protections in place.
Yes.
You can't just go and try to circumvent.
No.
The process.
No, that stays. In fact, a warrant, let's say the City Commission wants to approve a warrant. If the Historic Preservation Board doesn't approve the project still cannot move forward.
And that has to go through that process before it comes to us instead of us amending the code. And I think the HPB and DRB process has to be prior to the warrant coming before us.
I think the way we have it structured, it's in the middle. So the commission needs to show that they are interested in the warrant. Then the HPB and DRB would approve it. Then it would have to come back to the City Commission for final approval.
Yes, but that puts a lot of pressure on the members of the HPB, and it doesn't allow for independence. Because first, if it goes before the HPB, they're free to opine on it, give us their professional recommendation, which is what they're supposed to do. And then it comes to us once it's approved. Because otherwise, we appoint those people, and the process gets tainted.
Let me just ask, Mr. Attorney, what's the current process?
The current process is that the design of any project in a historic district requires HPB approval, and outside the historic districts would require DRB approval. I think that it makes sense for the warrant to come before the commission first, because whether the commission grants the warrant is going to have an impact on the design. And under the code, the DRB and HPB are required to approve the final design.
Yeah, currently, if I could just add to that real quick, we always require that the commission, at a minimum, refer an ordinance amendment to the planning board before we will allow it to go forward to a land use board. And the reason for that is because we don't want a land use board taking action on a project that's subject to a potential or conceptual amendment because they could make a vested rights argument. We require indemnification if they go before a land use board prior to the City Commission adopting a code change, but at least having the commission refer it to the planning board with that hold harmless gives us a much higher degree of protection. Here, I think Nick's correct. You would at least want to review the warrant and give some preliminary feedback before we take it to a land use board so that they don't claim later that they've got this vested right based upon the fact that the land use board has approved it with that.
But can we do like what we do right now, that we do a referral before the two hearings of the warrant at the City Commission?
That's what we want to do. That's what I'm saying that we should.
Is that possible?
The way it's set up now, correct me if I'm wrong.
Because I would feel more comfortable.
Somebody would make the application for the warrant and it would come before the commission. The commission would decide whether or not it's going to go forward. At that point, we would take it to the applicable land use board. Assuming the land use board approved it, it would then come back here for final approval of the warrant. Okay. So you could take a look at any changes that may have been made or required by that land use board.
Okay. Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez, and then let's continue after this question, the presentation.
Some of the situations that we currently find ourselves in right now is that the commission will grant zoning. And then it goes, and so these applicants think, oh, I'm just going to get this zoning. Now this item goes in front of the DRB and or the HPB. And these board members are feeling a tremendous amount of pressure because we have already approved this. And then sometimes they reject the entire application. So now we've made somebody hire an attorney, go through this code amendment process, and then their application gets dismissed. Why would we do that? Why not streamline the process by requiring first that it go through either design review or HPP, then come to us? Then we understand whether it's good or not. We're not. I'm not an historic preservation expert, and I know that we get recommendations from you, but I would like to get the recommendation of the board first before we go ahead, and because people are spending a lot of money. And I know people who've had their applications refused, and they are very upset. Or they get refused two or three times. Don't you think that they should go before a board first and say, am I going to get rejected? What do you need from me? That way, by the time they come to us, it's just a better process. Because what you guys are doing is you have the process reversed, and you're it's right. causing a lot of angst. The only people who suffer really are the applicants.
Let's go ahead and continue with the presentation. And then we can get back to the questions from the committee.
Okay.
Okay, so last bullet point is, again, no changes to the historic preservation regulations and process, and same with the design review process. Next slide, please. The next chapter, Chapter 3, that's concurrency management and mobility fees. We're not proposing any changes to this chapter. Real, essentially stays the same. Next slide. Chapter 4 is the landscape chapter. We are modifying requirements slightly to promote shade trees and drought and salt tolerant species suitable to Miami Beach. We're including minimum soil volumes, expanding requirements for drought and salt tolerant species, and increasing stormwater permeability in parking lots, but otherwise the landscape requirements stay the same. Next slide. For Chapter 5 is the off-street parking chapter. We're proposing to simplify requirements a little bit, but essentially all existing parking regulations will be remaining the same. We are proposing to reorganize our current 9 parking districts into 3 tiers. Within each tier, we'll have sub-areas, which essentially will equal our current parking districts. Tier 1 is essentially going to be District 1, which is citywide district that's not in a special parking district. Tier 2 is our requirements for districts 5, 6, 7, and 9, which is our intermediate parking requirements. And then Tier 3 is currently our districts 2, 3, 4, and 8, which has our lowest parking requirements in the city. So we're proposing to organize them this way just to make it easier for our staff to find things and know what they're looking for, but all of the requirements are essentially the same. One change to this chapter is that we are proposing to expand bicycle parking requirements citywide. Currently, we only require bicycle parking in District 8, which is the North Beach Town Center, and District 6, which is Alton Road. We're proposing now that since the voters approved an FAR exception for bicycle parking, that we require the bicycle parking citywide. We also have new regulations for the repair of nonconforming parking lots because there was an inconsistency with how that was interpreted for nonconformances, so that it would allow parking lots to be repaired. Next slide, please. Chapter 6, this is our chapter on signage. We're just including some minor clarifications for sign review responsibilities. We're adding some definitions for types of signs, standardizing some of the requirements, and then reorganizing for readability, including the addition of graphics that make it much easier for an applicant to understand the type of signage that we're referring to. Next slide. For zoning districts, we are proposing consolidated minimum unit size regulations in Chapter 7 of the code. All of our districts, with a few exceptions, have the same minimum unit size requirements, so we're going to have a standardized table. If a specific district has a different requirement, that will still be located in the district. We're not proposing any change to that. We are proposing to remove the average unit size calculations in order to simplify code requirements and make projects less exclusionary. However, that does not affect the maximum allowable density. That is still in the code and in the comprehensive plan, and we're not proposing any changes to the maximum density. Next slide, please. We're proposing to create clear use tables in each zoning district. You can see on the left how our uses are organized today. They're very, very difficult to read. It's in paragraph form where you see the permitted, the prohibited, the conditional, and the accessory uses. We're proposing what's on the right of this slide, which is organizing everything into tables. Several of our uses have special conditions of when they are allowed, certain conditions that they're required in order to allow the use. So in those cases, you'll see an asterisk, and it'll tell you immediately below what those special circumstances are for that use. We expect this to make it much easier for our staff to review and for residents to know exactly what's allowed on each type of property and within each zoning district. Next slide. We're proposing to restructure development regulations into tables for all zoning districts. We're proposing a consistent structure for all districts and utilizing tables and graphics to simplify the code structure. Currently, each district is drafted in a different format depending on the district, so it makes it very difficult when our staff is looking for something. It's not uniform. They have to look at in different places for different districts. So you'll see what we have on the left, tables and paragraph form and things in all sorts of formats. We're proposing everything to be uniform the way it is on the right with tables so that applicants can see where the building should be oriented on a site, where they can build, what their setbacks are, what their height limits are in a much more organized fashion, and everything will look the same in each individual zoning district.
Yeah, but by the way, I thought this was one of the big wins of going this route. I mean, especially for homeowners who don't do this for a living, the visual aids are just makes it so much user-friendly.
Yes.
So, for sure.
Yes, thank you. Next slide. In terms of our development regulations, we are moving some things around to make them easier to find. We're creating a new chapter for prohibited uses, which is where our citywide prohibited uses are located, such as gambling and casinos. We're moving our assisted living regulations into a supplementary use regulations, and then also incorporating our prohibition on rentals into this section, rentals of mopeds, motorcycles into this section as well. As well as the prohibition on neighborhood and retail fulfillment centers into this section. So it's all located in one place. For all zoning districts, we're including the residential density limits that are currently located in the comprehensive plan. Currently, those are not identified in the zoning ordinance, so an applicant needs to come in and they need to look at the comprehensive plan, and then they need to look at the zoning code separately. So we're proposing to move everything into one place to make it easier for our staff, frankly, and then for applicants. And then for supplementary use regulations, one big clarification is we're clarifying that landing and storage of helicopters is only allowed in the health district, so that would be the Mount Sinai site, and it's not allowed on private properties because we have had a lot of interest in people wanting to land helicopters in their homes. Yes?
Commissioner, you're recognized.
Out of curiosity, if somebody was, building a commercial building and wanted to have a helipad on top, why would we not allow it?
Our city is very dense. We have residential uses next to commercial uses. We don't have any really isolated commercial areas. And so helicopters landing in a district where you have residents nearby could be problematic with the noise and safety.
I wouldn't have a problem if people came before us and it was something that wasn't going to bother anyone else and they wanted to do it on a rooftop someplace. I don't know. Everybody seems we're attracting these mega billionaires, don't they, helicopter?
That's something that you certainly could look at on a case-by-case basis down the road in terms of a code amendment to allow for helicopter landing pads if approved by the FAA. There are some buildings in the city of Miami that do have helicopter pads on top of those buildings, but that is in a very dense downtown area. If you did determine that from a policy standpoint there is either an area or certain buildings that could accommodate a hotel or a helicopter landing pad, that's something that you could certainly look at on a case-by-case basis.
And that's something that could also be done through the warrant process, or no?
No, because that would affect uses.
Got it. Yep. All right. You have any?
The warrant process is for numerical standards.
I guess it allows Mount Sinai to potentially commercialize their hub because they're the only helicopter landing pad in the entire city, correct?
Potentially, but in my experience, most people that want to take a helicopter, they want to go directly to their residence. They wouldn't want to go to Mount Sinai and then have to deal with traffic getting all the way to wherever they are, particularly if they're further up the beach.
All right. You have more slides?
One more slide.
Okay.
Next slide, please. We have made some minor changes since first reading to the code. The first is Chapter 2. As a result of the referendum, which requires that there be an architect on category on the Board of Adjustments, so we've incorporated that into the code. For zoning districts and regulations, we've updated the section related to lot split regulations for single-family lots to be consistent with state law requirements. Same for the demolition procedures for single-family homes. We've updated that to be consistent with state law. And then we incorporated a requirement for the 40th Street religious overlay. It was amended slightly to allow existing parking spaces on a property to be discontinued, provided that there is one or more parking lots or garages within 500 feet. However, in the event that the religious institution goes back to being a single-family residence, they would have to put those parking spaces back. So those are the only clarifications that have been made since first reading. And so that's it for this presentation. If we have Max Zavala online from Gridix, I'd like to turn it over to him if he could share his screen and if he's available. If not, we have a backup plan. He's available.
PJ, move him in. All right, there we go.
Yes, hello, good afternoon. I'm available. I can share my screen.
Afternoon.
So I'm going to be presenting a portion that is in line with all of these amendments and is the Gridix platform that will actually have a digital version online of the text and also a map version. Part of the offer that we're bringing to the city of Miami Beach is a landing page that can have multiple links, again, really just to help adding an easier access to the general public to some of the major elements. As you can see here, one of them will be to the text and to the map. This is the first draft of what has been provided to us and is already in our system. The advantage of this system is that it does let you navigate through the different sections of the text fairly easily. We can also interlink both definitions and also links to different sections of the code. And of course, you can also share these links. So we're definitely hoping that this will do communication with the general public and staff much easier. Meaning that if there's something that they can be shared, they can just share a particular link via email, and they will be taken to the right section. We also offer tools for the general public, such as printing and downloaded sections of the particular text of the code. And let me just navigate to a different section. As you've been seeing on the presentation, they've been adding a lot of graphics, and our system can definitely add these graphics into the system. And in addition to that, we can also visualize some of the tables for the users in the very same way. One interesting component of the system is that it does have a map partner that comes with it. So in the map component, it's a full interactive 3D system that it can be also rotated as a 2D plan for those that like to navigate it in that way. The intention of this map is that we're going to be displaying basically any layer that, thinking of GIS layer, that can actually be useful for interpretations of the code. So, of course, the zoning will be number one. But all of the other overlays that has been mentioned during the presentation can also be loaded into a system. This will allow users to, of course, navigate and see what's available. In addition to that, we also run part of what we offer as part of our platform is we do transfer all of those regulations into our system, and it has the ability to calculate every single parcel. And essentially, we'll transfer certain things. So, for example, let's click a parcel over here. When this is displayed, it will give you some of the information that is available from Miami-Dade County property appraiser. So address, folio number, legal description, that type of information. But then most importantly, the basic zoning tab will actually give you some of the basic information of the zoning that is applicable to that particular parcel. This will include descriptions of the zone and links back to the text, as we were saying, we were showing you before. We also have a full, wanted to show you also the overlays. So again, this is one of the advantages that we offer, that our system offer. It will do all of that, I guess, overlapping or layering already for you. If there's multiple overlays that will affect a particular parcel, it will let you know in advance that those exist. So in this particular case, it's telling you that it's within the Sunset Harbor District overlay, and it does belong to Parking Tier 2. And again, each one of these can have a description and links back to the text, so you get to see all the specifics. Further down, it will actually go one step further, and it will try to clarify some of the basic elements of the code for you. So the density, for example, or height limitation, or FAR, will actually be telling you that specifically. And to just top it off, it will actually also have the list of uses that are particularly permitted, either with condition or the variation for that parcel in particular. It also has the ability to allow for searches. So let's look at the search for another property. Let's say this one, just so you see the variation. Once you search for that property, you're going to be navigated to there. And now you see all of this interface has been changed, because now it's showing you, of course, the zoning and all of the specific information for that particular parcel right here. So I really just wanted to give you a general overview of this couple of things. We are going to be offering other systems. Like, for example, you can filter properties out if you don't want to do a particular search, like, for example, all the parcels that are a certain size. And by the way, that is also true on the text component. So if I just click here to text, and it's going to be navigated on this side. And let's say that I want to share, look for everything that says short-term rental throughout the text. And it's essentially going to find it for you. This is the platform that we definitely intend to, once the code and if it gets approved, going to be implemented and updated in the system.
Okay. So I think that's it for us. The other benefit to this system is we'll be in charge of updating it. So currently our current coding system takes several months from when an amendment is adopted to when it's actually live and online and available to the public. This will be managed by us for land use code amendments. So as soon as they're adopted and effectuated, we'll be able to update them, and they'll be available to the public immediately. So right. That's it.
Very good. Thank you. Let's do something before we bring this back to the day, since I see members of the public present, and it was noticed by the city clerk at the beginning that we would take public comment. Let me just open up the floor to members of the public. If you wish to speak, I see Daniel and Gail here. I don't know if virtually we have any members. No? Okay. So, Gail, you're welcome. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Rogelio. We spoke about this at the planning board, but there's a couple points you brought up today that we didn't discuss at the planning board. I was wondering, removing the average size of units from all districts, what was the advantage to that? I saw perhaps a disadvantage. Right now you can have a minimum size of 550 square feet unit, but the overall average unit size for the building has to be 800 square feet. So if we make this change that you're recommending, does that mean all the units in the building can be the minimum size, 550?
Let's let Gail ask her questions, and then...
Well, that was... Okay. There's two areas that I had a question about. So that was the first area. The second area is, clarifying the percentage of allowable accessory uses. So it is 49% now, and you're trying to bring it down to 35%, which I think a lot of people will appreciate. That means accessory uses, you know, restaurants and bars can only be 35% of the main use. I think that's a good thing. But can we perhaps include the outdoor areas? It says 35% of the floor area of the indoor areas, because the outdoor areas are the problem spaces. The outdoor area gets all the noise complaints, So I don't know, does it make sense that we should also include in that 35% not just the indoor areas, but also the outdoor areas? I mean, the classic example is the Bikini Hostel. They really don't have any indoor bar areas. It's all outdoor, and that causes, you know, all the problems in our neighborhood. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Mooney, I think you wanted to answer some of these questions.
Sure. First, with regard to the proposal to remove the average unit size requirements, one of the things that we've noticed over the last couple of years, and this is also a recommendation of our consultant, is that having an average unit size, particularly as high as it is, of 800 square feet, is not just exclusionary, but it prevents the ability for people to do what we would commonly characterize as attainable housing. We have a provision in the code now that removes average unit size requirements for workforce and affordable housing, but what we found oftentimes is that when people are forced to do 800 square foot units, they end up defaulting to the luxury model and building really big units. Secondly, there's not a requirement that you build 550 square foot units. If you want to do the luxury model and build bigger units, you can certainly do that. But by having only a minimum of 550, we're still controlling the total number of units because the density limits have not been modified. So they're not going to be able to add any more units. But it provides more flexibility for people to be able to develop something other than the luxury model. On the percentage, we did look at the exterior of uses, and what we found was that it's very difficult to measure what would be considered part of an outdoor area and what wouldn't. What we found is that by limiting it to 35% of an interior space, that it's a much more definable measurement, and it's something that will provide what we think is a more balanced approach to making sure that accessory uses are clearly subordinate to the main permitted use. Under a long interpretation of 49%, that includes basically everything, but it doesn't really define what areas are counted. And what we found is that the areas that have the largest outdoor areas are the areas that are in the RM3 district, and those are generally going to be well under 35% because most of the buildings in the RM3 district are either 80 to 90% hotel or residential units, which is the main permitted use. So that's why we wouldn't recommend adding exterior areas to the percentage of allowable accessory uses because it becomes too difficult to define those exterior areas. And most exterior areas also require a certain amount of indoor area to be considered an accessory use anyway.
Okay. With that, are there any more public comments? Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Daniel Serrato with Miami Design Preservation League. I also had some questions for possibly for Tom. I think that what was mentioned is that a warrant would not be possible for FAR. So that's a good thing, because I wasn't clear on that originally. I do think that having the Historic Preservation Board and the DRB take a look is a good idea. I've been in the middle, as you all know, a lot of times. Like, the most recent one was the Versailles Hotel, where the commission got all excited when the developers came and gave the big height increase, but then the neighbors came and were not happy. Then there was some sort of settlement. But all those things could be figured out better if there is that process, public process, in the beginning rather than later, because it does kind of put pressure on the board members of those boards. The other thing is that I believe the consultant had suggested 2 times per year for the zoning changes. So I don't know. Wasn't it 2 times per year for the zoning? But you can answer after. But okay. I guess now there's 4, which, you know, I could probably guess where it comes from. But I think that, you know, there's just so many, so much pressure on all of you and all of us from the lobbyists that want to change the zoning. And, you know, so I'd be interested to know if the consultant suggested 2 or 4, because 4 times a year is sort of what we already have, although now it's more like 12 times a year, because it seems like every month there's a zoning change. So anything that could be done to relieve that would be good. Final thing is, with the single-family homes, They're removing the understory from DRB. I think it's a bad idea because the state removed everything from DRB. And so now to say also the understory, you're adding 3 feet to that, and then another three, you know, it's like you're talking about 40-foot houses. I think we should keep the oversight. And if I could add maybe 30 seconds
yes.
just to wrap up, thank yes. you. The other thing I want to mention, we haven't really had time to talk about it, but with that home rule preemption that was done by the state recently, already Palm Beach and Coral Gables are taking a lead on trying to regain that home rule that was stripped from our municipalities. And I think they will be successful ultimately, but I guess my question is, with this change in the zoning, if the home rule is regained, is there a way we can make it sort of automatic that we get all those DRB processes back without having to go through from scratch? Because the processes we have, I think, even though some people don't like them, I think they benefited the city well, the economics of our city, and we want to make sure it's
Thank
all
you.
Addressed. Thank,
Thank
you.
You so much. Thank you. Any more public comments? No? All right. With that, we're going to close the public comment. Mr. Mooney, I don't know if you'd like to answer any other questions from Mr. Serraldo.
Yeah, I think, Daniel, your only question was with regard to the cycle for code amendments. And the number of 4 times per year is something that we came up with collectively with the consultant. We felt that twice a year might be too limited, and 4 times a year was something that was much more manageable. Certainly, it's a lot more manageable than the current process, which, as you said, it's monthly. So we think 4 times a year would strike that careful balance.
Thank you. Colleagues, I want to bring this back to the dais. Does the body have any additional questions, comments? Commissioner Riola.
Yeah, I just want to thank Rogelio and Tom and the whole team for going through this. I know you've been at this well over a year, right? Maybe going on 2? Yeah, yeah. Really fine work. I mean, I fully support it. I mean, we can, you know, tweak a few things, but I think it's really great work. It's going to serve our community well. So I just want to thank you guys.
Thank you. Commissioner Wilson Gonzalez, you're recognized.
I think it's great that you're modernizing the code and we have technology now. My only worry about this, or what I think we should remove from this, is removing the average unit size, because I think what you're going to get is a lot of minimum unit sizes. You're going to end up with a lot of 550 square foot units. And what does that lend itself to? Short-term rentals. What are we having all of our issues with? Short-term rentals. And at the end of the day, we know that even though we have an ordinance in place, it's very hard to enforce based on state statutes. So what we're doing right now is kind of giving a license to someplace transient. Because people, a family, would you live with your family in 550 square feet? No, you wouldn't. So, we've already decreased, okay, the minimum unit size. I think it was 600 or 650 feet before. So if you eliminate the average unit size, forget it. We're going to get 550 square foot, units across the city, and those become transient. There's not people who are going to live there, you know, even if they do, it's for a minimal amount of time, renters. So, and if people do want to build something that needs some sort of a warrant, they could come to us and we could give them the warrant. So why do we have to put that in place so that we're just going to get short-term rentals across the city? I think that policy is not what we want to do, especially because right now, we have 30,000 hotel rooms in the city. We're building another 3,000 hotel rooms. We're fighting across the city, offering incentives so that people don't build these short-term rental units. This is not what we want to do, I don't think.
Thank you. And I shared the same sentiment about the unit sizes. I'd rather see that be through an application that comes to us through a warrant that we as a body could, offer some leeway to an individual based on the market demand that they come forward and they feel that smaller unit is needed. They can come and request that, and we can approve that on a case by case basis, especially with this new warrant tool that we would have. Especially if they're willing to make some concessions as safeguards that protect the quality of life of our neighborhoods. Commissioner Riola, you're recognized.
Yeah, look, I think all of us get very concerned around short-term rentals. I certainly do.
and we've got mechanisms for protecting against that, particularly for new applications of buildings. I mean, we can make, basically, you know, make it impossible for them to build that. What I worry about is, you know, sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You know, we're worried that smaller units will lead to short-term rentals. But what it also will do if you restrict it, it also prohibits new entrants into the real estate market. So, you know, kids getting out of college and going to get their first apartment, if they can't afford, you know, 1,000, 1,200, 1,500 square foot apartments, will just be priced out of the market. Retirees, same thing. I mean, developers won't build small units if there wasn't a demand for it. And the folks that typically want those units are folks that, like I said, are retirees, they don't have families, or young people who don't have families. So I just want to make sure that we have a product for everybody who wants to live and work in Miami Beach. And so if we're overly restrictive on unit size, then we're basically, you know, wiping out an entire generation of new entrants into Miami Beach who, you know, want to live here and build their careers here. And eventually, when they get married and start having families, they'll move into single-family homes or larger unit sizes. So I don't want to be overly restrictive simply because we're afraid of short-term rentals. I think we have other mechanisms for dealing with that. And I want to make sure we have product for, you know, every level of person who wants to live in Miami Beach.
Thank you, Commissioner Arreola. Commissioner Minor, you haven't spoken yet. Do you have any questions, comments for the benefit of staff? Okay, great. And I'll just end with just one last comment. I would like to get some better clarity in the future, not right now, about the process for the warrants. I would like to see us having the mechanism of maybe first having the warrants reviewed by HPB or DRB before we do that first approval of it. I do have a concern that if we first approve it, then we send it to the land use boards. We do put some sort of unintended pressure, not intended by the body, by the city commission, but just by the process. You know, here we are, the body that appoints them, now sending them this already with a first blessing from the city commission. So something for if you could get with me, I would like to review further.
Yeah, we can definitely, my thought was perhaps we could come up with a couple of different options, because what I think you guys are talking about is the sequencing. And so right. We can easily tweak the sequencing of it. But right. We can certainly get with you offline before the 26th. And go over some different options.
Sure. Because the review is still the same. The public notices are still the same. So it's just, as you well stated, the sequencing. And then, Commissioner Arreola, you're right. We don't want to create a void of a specific market. And so we want to be mindful of that. And that's why I think these warrants are a good tool, because we can go then on a case-by-case basis and put those safeguards in place. Staff, thank you so much. If there's no more business before us, Mr. Attorney, Mr. Clerk.
And can no I more? Just
yes.
end with one thing? If any members of the commission have any questions prior to October 26th, myself or Helio, the rest of my staff, are available for individual briefings. Just feel free to reach out and let us know.
Thank you. Thank you, staff, to the members of the public that attended. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
Nice work. You run a good meeting.